Welcome to your deep dive. We've got quite the mix of sources this time, all on early Genesis, Abraham, Sodom and Gomorrah, even Jacob and Esau.
Yeah, really foundational stuff.
We're going to untangle some seriously deep questions about faith, about family dynamics.
And how these stories from, you know, thousands of years ago still have something to say to us today.
It's like opening a time capsule, right? Packed with ethical dilemmas and cultural clashes, we often just skim the surface of these narratives.
Exactly. There's so much more beneath, layers of meaning waiting to be unpacked.
So let's dive in, shall we? Starting with Abraham, the sister act he pulls, passing Sarah off as his sister, not once, but twice, to protect himself. I mean, how do we even begin to make sense of that?
It's certainly jarring, isn't it, when you look at it through a modern lens, for sure.
Right, like today's world.
But we have to remember, the cultural landscape was vastly different back then. And this practice, while seemingly deceptive to us, might have been a way to leverage societal structures for protection.
So you're saying instead of a straightforward introduction, it becomes a calculated strategy for survival?
In a way, yes. It's a way to navigate the complexities of their society, the ancient Near East. And we see this kind of thing pop up quite a bit in the historical record.
But it still raises questions about morality of his actions, right? I mean, he's putting Sarah in a potentially compromising situation.
Absolutely. And the text doesn't shy away from that tension. It forces us to grapple with the complexities of cultural relativism, doesn't it? What's considered unethical to us could have been a necessary tactic in Abraham's world.
And it highlights the immense pressure he was under, right? A stranger in a strange land, trying to protect his wife, fulfill God's promise.
Exactly. It's easy to judge from our comfortable armchairs.
Yeah.
But when you consider the stakes, the dangers he faced,
it adds a whole new layer of complexity. Okay, speaking of cultural context and complexities, let's talk about Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. That's a story loaded with debate, especially regarding its interpretation around sexuality.
But before we go there, I want to touch on the hospitality aspect, something Dr. Hildebrandt really emphasizes in his lecture, how crucial hospitality was in the desert.
Absolutely vital. Almost sacred, you could say. I mean, picture the harshness of that environment.
Right, the scorching heat, limited resources.
A stranger at your tent could mean the difference between life and death. So you offer them shelter, food, protection.
Hmm.
Regardless of who they are.
Even, like, an enemy.
Even an enemy. It's hard to wrap our minds around that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hildebrandt points to the Bedouin custom of offering shelter to a mortal enemy for 3 days. It speaks to a deep-seated belief that even in conflict, basic human dignity must be upheld.
That level of trust is hard to fathom today, but it reminds me of that story, you know, about the Navy SEAL in Afghanistan. Hunted by the Taliban, but protected by the village elder.
Wow, yeah. Powerful example. It's like those ancient codes of conduct are still echoing in parts of the world.
Exactly. Like, hardship and shared values can forge a powerful sense of community. It makes you wonder, where do we see echoes of that ancient hospitality in our own lives today?
Hmm. That's a good question. One worth pondering.
Okay, so back to Sodom and Gomorrah. We had these angels arriving, Lot offering them hospitality, but then this terrifying mob appears, demanding that Lot hand over his guests for... Well, let's just say their intentions are far from hospitable.
Yes, the text is quite explicit there. And it's this moment where the concept of hospitality takes on an even deeper meaning.
It's not just about offering comfort anymore.
It becomes about fiercely protecting your guests, even if it means risking your own safety, your own life even.
And Lot, in this desperate attempt to protect his guests, he offers his daughters instead. It feels like, even in that context, a line's been crossed. Does the cultural context truly justify such a choice?
It's a disturbing detail, that's for sure. And one that forces us to confront just how ethically complex that time was.
I mean, how can we even process that?
Dr. Hildebrandt suggests that Lot, bound by the laws of hospitality, he might have seen it as, well, the lesser of two evils. A horrifying thought, but it speaks to the desperation of his situation.
It's hard to reconcile that with, you know, our modern understanding of morality.
Absolutely. And this passage has been, as you know, interpreted in so many ways, often used to condemn homosexuality.
Right. But Dr. Hildebrandt also highlights the, the gay interpretation, which focuses on the violation of hospitality as the primary sin.
Right. And it's important, I think, to acknowledge those diverse viewpoints. This passage compels us to grapple with challenging questions about sin, about judgment, about societal norms. And there are no easy answers.
No easy answers, but we can't shy away from the conversation.
Exactly. We have to wrestle with these tough questions, honestly and openly.
It reminds me of my friend Susie. She's a lesbian, and she's faced so much judgment and condemnation from people who claim to follow the same faith. It's like, how do we reconcile the command to love our neighbor with these deeply ingrained prejudices?
That's the challenge, isn't it? And it reminds us of that crucial concept.
Yeah.
Loving the sinner, hating the sin.
But how do you hold those two seemingly contradictory ideas together? It's a difficult balance.
It is. A delicate balance. But I think it's essential if we're going to navigate these complex issues with both truth and love.
Not about compromising our convictions, but also not about judging and condemning others.
Precisely. It calls for humility. Recognizing that none of us have all the answers. And ultimately, we're called to reflect the love of Christ in all that we do.
Absolutely. All right, shifting gears a bit, let's delve into the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, arguably the ultimate test of faith. God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son, the son he waited decades for. I mean, talk about an impossible choice.
It's a story that continues to resonate across millennia, forces us to confront those profound questions about obedience, sacrifice, the nature of God.
What always strikes me is the starkness of the text. Like Dr. Hildebrandt points out, it's almost devoid of emotion. Abraham goes through the motions, but there's no mention of his inner turmoil.
And that's what makes it so powerful, right? It invites us to step into the story, to imagine the agonizing struggle within Abraham's heart. What would it mean for us to face that kind of test, to surrender our own precious, so to speak, without reservation?
It's like Kierkegaard explores in Fear and Trembling that wrestling with the paradox of faith.
Right. The willingness to surrender, even the seemingly irrational, to a God we may not fully understand.
And Dr. Hildebrandt even shares that deeply personal story about his own son serving in Afghanistan. That feeling of helplessness, of surrendering control and trusting God when the stakes are incredibly high.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Just the thought of your child in harm's way. It's a visceral reminder that faith isn't just about blind obedience.
It's about choosing to trust, even when it doesn't make sense.
Precisely. And the story of the Akedah isn't just about Abraham's obedience. It foreshadows something far greater. It points to God's own sacrifice, the ultimate act of love.
Right. Sending his son to die for us. It blows my mind when you consider that detail Dr. Hildebrandt calls spatial doubling, Mount Moriah, where Abraham's told to sacrifice Isaac. That's also where Jesus would be crucified.
It's like the Bible's creating a map where these ancient locations become layered with meaning.
It connects these events across centuries, linking Abraham's test of faith to the ultimate sacrifice. It's a lot to process.
It is. It speaks to the incomprehensible depth of God's love and the mystery of his ways, a mystery we can only begin to explore.
Wow. Okay, so from the profound faith of Abraham to the complex dynamics of family, we now turn to Jacob and Esau. Those twin brothers locked in a seemingly endless power struggle. It's like sibling rivalry taken to an epic level.
And their story starts even before they're born, right? With that prophecy Rebecca receives, that the older will serve the younger, it sets the stage for a lifetime of conflict and intrigue.
Yeah, that detail about Jacob grabbing Esau's heel as they're being born, talk about foreshadowing. It's like their rivalry was baked in from the very beginning.
Their very names even hint at the drama to come. Jacob, evoking the idea of deceiver or heel grabber. While Esau, meaning red, foreshadows the Edomites, his descendants, who will become associated with violence and conflict.
It's all there right from the start.
Woven into their very identities.
And then there's that whole birthright incident. Esau comes home starving, and Jacob, always the opportunist, offers him some red stew in exchange for his birthright. Talk about driving a hard bargain.
It was a legal transaction back then in the ancient Near East, but it reveals Jacob's cunning, his ambition. He takes advantage of his brother's weakness, sets a pattern for their relationship. Yeah, and it really sets off a chain reaction. Esau's enraged, vows to kill Jacob.
So Jacob has to flee for his life. I mean, talk about family drama. From bartering for birthrights to plotting murder, you'd think a family blessed by God would be a little more, I don't know, functional.
Well, it is a stark reminder, isn't it? That even those chosen by God are still human, wrestling with their flaws, their impulses, and Jacob's actions. They have lasting consequences, impact him and his descendants for generations.
Let's talk about ripple effects. So Jacob's on the run. He's heading to his uncle Laban's place. Then along the way, he has that dream, you know, the ladder to heaven, angels ascending and descending. It's such a vivid image.
It's a pivotal moment, a theophany, a direct encounter with the divine. It marks a turning point, you could say, in Jacob's relationship with God.
Like a reset button.
In a way, yeah. It's reassurance, I think. That even in his flawed humanity, he's still part of God's plan.
It's like God saying, hey, Jacob, I see you with all your baggage, and I'm not giving up on you.
Exactly. God reaffirms those covenant promises made to Abraham, extends them to Jacob.
It's a message of grace and faithfulness, even when we stray.
Right. God's always there, ready to welcome us back.
Okay, so Jacob gets to Laban's place, and, well, of course, he falls for Rachel, the younger daughter, but, like, it wouldn't be a Genesis story without a little more deception, right?
Of course not. And Laban, in a twist of irony, he tricks Jacob into marrying Leah first, the older daughter.
Oh, man. It's like trickery is the family heirloom. Makes you wonder if those recurring patterns are meant to highlight something about human nature itself.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
It certainly showcases the complexities, right? The interplay of good and bad, faithfulness and deceit.
So Jacob ends up with two wives, Leah and Rachel, each bearing him children. And ultimately, this leads to the 12 tribes of Israel.
And that whole family dynamic, fraught with tension, it echoes the conflict between Jacob and Esau. It's like, even as God's plan unfolds, human relationships stay messy, complicated.
It's like the sins of the father are echoed in the next generation. But it also shows that God can work through those imperfect situations.
Absolutely, those flawed individuals, to accomplish his purposes. It challenges our simplistic notions of good and evil, doesn't it?
Right. God's story often unfolds in unexpected ways. So eventually, Jacob decides, all right, it's time to go back home.
But after decades of separation, he must have been filled with anxiety about facing Esau again. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Right. So he sends gifts ahead, tries to appease his brother, but then he has that powerful encounter with God at the Jabbok River.
The wrestling match.
I've always found that image so intriguing. It's like, what's the deeper meaning there? What's going on?
It's a metaphor, I think. For Jacob's inner struggle, confronting his past, the nature of God, it's a moment of transformation, wrestling not just with an angel, but with his own identity.
And it results in a new name, Israel, he who struggles with God. It's powerful. Like, our faith journey isn't about passive acceptance.
It's about active engagement, willingness to grapple with the tough questions.
To wrestle with God, even. And in that struggle, there's a sense of victory. Emerging from the darkness transformed.
Exactly. So finally, the moment of truth arrives. Jacob and Esau, face to face. And surprisingly, Esau welcomes him back, open arms.
You'd expect a showdown after all those years, some epic confrontation.
Instead, we get this moment of reconciliation. It's a testament to the power of forgiveness. It reminds us that even the most fractured relationships, they have the potential for healing.
But there's still a sense of unease, isn't there? Like, Esau invites Jacob to settle nearby, but Jacob declines, chooses to go his own way.
There's a lingering tension, yeah. A recognition that the past can't be completely erased. But there's also a glimmer of hope, wouldn't you say?
That these brothers can coexist even if their paths diverge.
Yeah, I think so.
So we've journeyed from Abraham's call to faith through Sodom and Gomorrah to the saga of Jacob and Esau. It's incredible how these ancient stories still resonate.
They offer a timeless reflection on the human condition. Our struggles with faith, family dynamics, that yearning for meaning and connection.
It's like looking into a mirror, recognizing those same desires, anxieties in ourselves.
And it reminds us that we're not alone in those struggles. Not by a long shot.
Yeah, it's like these stories tap into those really deep human experiences. Our longings, our anxieties, our struggles with faith and identity, our search for meaning and purpose. In a world that often feels chaotic and uncertain, right?
Yeah, they really do. It's a timeless mirror to the human condition, I think, reflecting both our flaws and our potential, that capacity we have for both profound love and just devastating betrayal.
And in the midst of all that, we see glimmers of redemption, where brokenness gives way to healing, where doubt transforms into faith.
It's a reminder that even in our darkest moments, God's grace is at work. Even when we can't see it.
So as we kind of wrap up this deep dive into early Genesis, what are some key takeaways our listeners should ponder?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's crucial to approach these stories with an awareness of that cultural context.
Right. They were written in a specific time and place with different customs and beliefs.
Right. We can't just impose our modern sensibilities onto these ancient narratives. We'll miss the nuances, the complexities.
We're like trying to understand the whole sister act thing through a 21st century lens. We need to step into their world.
Exactly. Consider their social structures, their cultural norms, to really grasp the motivations behind those choices.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
Secondly, I think these stories really invite us to some serious self-reflection about our own faith.
Oh, yeah.
What does it mean to trust God, even when it's hard? When it doesn't make sense, what are we willing to surrender for the sake of our beliefs.
Beketeter really comes to mind there.
It does, doesn't it? It's not just about Abraham's obedience, but about the nature of faith itself. What does it look like to truly surrender to God, embrace the unknown, even when it feels terrifying?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a big one.
And thirdly, these stories remind us that God works through flawed individuals.
Doesn't choose perfect people, right?
He uses ordinary people like you and me to accomplish extraordinary things. Mm-hmm. It's a message that's both humbling and incredibly empowering.
It's like we don't have to have it all together to be used by On.
Our imperfections, our messy humanity, they don't disqualify us. In fact, it's often through our brokenness that God's grace shines most brightly. And lastly, I think these stories offer us a glimpse into the very heart of God. We see his faithfulness, his relentless pursuit of us, of humanity, his willingness to work through our messiness to bring about redemption.
So as we wrap up, what stands out to you the most as we reflect on these ancient stories and their relevance for today?
You know, for me, it's the theme of reconciliation. It weaves its way through these narratives. It's there in the story of Jacob and Esau and the aftermath of Sodom and Gomorrah, even in Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac. It's a reminder that forgiveness is always possible, that broken relationships can be mended, that even after profound loss, there's a potential for healing, for new beginnings.
And here's a final thought to ponder. If we look back on our own lives, can we see those moments where God's been working, even when we were unaware? Those times when he's guided our steps, opened doors, or brought us through those difficult seasons. Maybe those experiences, those seemingly random events, are all part of a larger tapestry, a grand narrative that's still unfolding. Until next time, keep diving deep.